everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Kip Kosek on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Acts of Conscience, Christian Nonviolence, and Modern American Democracy. There's a bumper sticker I like that says, "Thou shalt not kill." He meant that part, the implication being that Christians, at least if you read the Bible, I guess, strictly and in a certain way, are not allowed to kill other people. And that includes contexts in which most of us would say killing is justified. This is a very difficult position to hold and live in the modern world, as the subjects in Kip's book would probably attest. They are a group of Christian pacifists who practiced a kind of nonviolence throughout the 20th century, and that includes in World War I and World War II and in the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Iraq War. They never really succeeded in their goal of creating a world without war, but they were at the forefront of many issues that were extraordinarily important in the 20th century, and I'll just mention a few of them, and they're discussed in the interview. They would be the civil liberties movement and the ACLU, that is concerning conscientious objection, but all civil liberties. Also, the civil rights movement, and particularly equality between or among the races in the 1950s, that is the American civil rights movement. Then the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and the anti-war movement today, I would say. So these people were extraordinarily important for 20th century American politics, and we should probably thank Kip for giving them the attention that they deserve. I really enjoyed talking to him today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Kip.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Pretty good.
Good. Glad to hear it. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Kip Kosek today, and we'll be discussing his really interesting new book, Acts of Conscience, Christian Nonviolence and Modern American Democracy. As I was telling Kip in the pre-interview, my wife is something of a Quaker, and she will, in a profoundly un-Quaker-like way, sometimes suggest that the Quakers are often on the right side of many issues. And I didn't really know much about this until I read Kip's fascinating book, which isn't just about Quakers, obviously. It's about Christian nonviolence in general in the 20th century. As it turns out, pacifists, were on the right side of many, many issues. And that's part of the fascination of the book, to see people with true convictions that happen to be really in tune with the broader zeitgeist, I guess I would say. But we can talk about that in due time. But it's a fascinating book, and I encourage you to go out and pick it up. Kip, why don't we begin the interview by having you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. I am I teach at George Washington University now in Washington, D.C., but I am originally a Midwesterner, and I was born in Wisconsin and a product of the great Wisconsin public schools. I grew up in a small city called Manitowoc between Green Bay and Milwaukee there on the lake. And I went to the University of Illinois for college and started off actually as an architecture major, but got really interested in history and took advantage of the outstanding history department at the University of Illinois. And that's where I really started to learn about thinking historically, and that's really fascinated me, and particularly, I guess, thinking historically about religions as something that isn't just about eternal and timeless truth, but religions as things that change and adapt over time. Then I went to the East Coast and went to Yale. And I took to grad school in an American Studies department, which was some historians, some people working on literature, some people working on contemporary culture, and other things. So an interdisciplinary focus, and again, an outstanding place to be with all kinds of smart and interesting people there. And there too, I got. There was a group there that was interested in thinking about American religion, a group that was drawn from American studies, history, religious studies, that met for discussion groups and so on. And that's where I really started this project, which was my dissertation I don't usually want to say that because it tends to drive away readers, but I try to take out the boring parts in turning it from a dissertation to a book.
You've done a fine job, let me say, listeners.
And so after that, I came to GW, George Washington, and was very fortunate to land in an American Studies department, which has a very capacious idea of what American culture and American history is about, people doing a lot of different things. And we really have a great interest in American religion and American social movements and race in American history and a lot of the things that I'm working on and that interests me. And that's where I finished doing the research and writing for this. And it's, you know, and Washington is a great place, obviously, to do this kind of work with the cultural resources and the research opportunities that one has at the Library of Congress. So it's been great. And now I live in Falls Church across the river in Virginia, and teach at GW.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's begin talking a little bit about the book itself, and I want to start in a kind of unusual place, and that is with the scriptures themselves. As I told you in the pre-interview, I was raised a Lutheran, so you know, we have this thing about scripture. I think before talking about people that are Christian pacifists or hold a non-violence creed, we have to talk about what the scripture itself says about violence. What does Jesus say about violence?
Wow, that's a contested issue, right? And I didn't know we were going to start with Jesus.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't really know either. It just occurred to me, well, these people were Christians, and they probably read the text too. So
I think that's important because, in fact, Jesus was at the center, I think, of what they of their religion. And that sounds obvious, but I think it was different groups have different emphasis, right? Even different Christian groups, right? Some people are more focused on the text of the Bible. Some people are more focused on maybe, you know, like the direct intervention of the Holy Spirit, right? And I think these people really focused on the life of Jesus and the example of Jesus. And particularly, you know, I think for them, the Sermon on the Mount is a big part of it, right? The idea of turning the other cheek, not returning evil for evil, right? But beyond what Jesus said in the red letters in the Bible, I think what these people were also focused on was the example of Jesus's life, right? And Jesus's death as a model for how the world works ultimately and how nonviolence works ultimately, that in defeat and in seeming defeat, right, Jesus is killed, right, that there is ultimately a kind of victory, and that that Jesus's choice not to respond with violence to his attackers ultimately gives him some kind of power or some kind of strength. So it's different. I mean, if you want to get into to technical theological points, you know, I think the people in my book have sort of interpreted Jesus differently than a lot of contemporary evangelicals, in which the point of Jesus' death is that Jesus died on the cross for our sins, right? And he was the substitution for the sinful world, right? And that's the significance of Jesus' death. I think the folks that I'm writing about saw the theology a little bit differently and saw Jesus' life as more of a model to follow than as a literal substitution for our sins. But but Jesus was absolutely central. And one of the things I wanted to say about these folks, because I think religious liberals are often seen as not very religious in a sense, right? That it's really the fundamentalists or whoever it is that are the really serious ones, you know, and liberals are kind of wishy-washy and not as engaged and a little suspect, right? But I wanted to say actually that these people had a real theology and a real a real religious intensity, right, in their focus on Jesus' life and on the Bible.
I want to move forward from the kind of interpretation of the Bible that these people might have held to the Middle Ages and the early modern period very briefly, because there is a background to modern nonviolence movements in particularly in the Radical Reformation, which here in Iowa lives among us in the form of Mennonites, who are all pacifists. They are they practice a strict kind of nonviolence and are always conscientious, not always, but usually conscientious objectors when it comes time to go to war. Can you talk a little bit about them and the role that they played in the minds of the folks you're talking about? How the people in the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is what we're going to be talking about in a second, how they thought about these traditional pacifistic Protestant sects?
Yeah, I think that on one hand I think they were they had kind of two ways of thinking about that kind of older tradition of pacifism. I mean, in one sense, they wanted to say again that this is a real Christian tradition, right, that goes all the way back to Jesus, right, and to the early Christians. But also, as you say, in the medieval and early modern period, the Mennonites with the Anabaptists, different kinds of radical Reformation groups, and so they are in some sense the heirs of that tradition and are indebted to that that strain of Christian pacifism and of critique of violence, and which is also a critique of the state in ways we can talk about and of politics. On the other hand, the people I'm writing about, I think, also thought that there was something new going on in the 20th century, and that there was something different about the kind of nonviolence that they were espousing, that they admired the Mennonites and you know, the Amish, other groups that we think about, right? But they also they were very self-conscious about not wanting, the people that I'm writing about were self-conscious about not wanting to be seen simply as traditional, right, as old-fashioned, as defending some kind of traditional values or something. They really wanted to be seen as modern people, and they wanted to suggest that nonviolence didn't mean that you had to go back to that you had to you know, ride in a horse and buggy and live on your farm, although some of them did want to go and live on farms. But that nonviolence was something that modern people could practice in the modern world. So there's a sense in which the people I'm writing about are part of that longer tradition that goes all the way back 2,000 years in Christianity. And there's also a sense, I think, in which they break with that a little bit and do something that's slightly different in response to the kind of unprecedented mass violence in the 20th century.
So how does the organization we're going to be talking about, just for the listener's sake, is called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. How does it get started?
So the group I'm looking at, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, or the FOR, as I'll probably refer to it, gets started during World War One, and this is what some people have called the first modern war, a war that's unprecedented in some ways in its destructive force and the number of people who are killed and in the efficiency with which people can be killed due to new technologies and so on. And it's much more destructive for Europe than it is for the United States. So for Europe, this tends to be for European historians, this tends to be a very important milestone in the history of that region. And for Americans, it tends to be more of a minor thing, right? It's nothing compared to World War II or the Civil War, right? And America is not in World War I very long. But for the people I'm writing about, World War I became really important for a couple of reasons. First, it sort of upset their belief, I think, in progress. So if you look at that period right before World War I, and even in the early days of World War I, lots of people would believe in peace pretty strongly, or even I think call themselves pacifists. So, you know, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, I believe it is William Jennings Bryan, who says he's a pacifist, right? It'd be hard to imagine someone in Obama's cabinet saying he or she is a pacifist, right? But this is possible, right? It seemed plausible. And even when the war breaks out in Europe, Americans are saying, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with this. The Europeans, and you know, we might expect this from them, but we're kind of beyond that, right? And so my people, the people that I'm writing about, are actually, I think, kind of, you know, they have a lot of company in thinking that war is outmoded, outdated. The world is too economically interconnected and culturally interconnected for war to make any sense, right? And then in 1917, the events kind of turn, and even going back a year or two before that, and the U.S. you know, eventually ends up entering the war, and suddenly there's great support for the U.S. Violently intervening in Europe. And so the people that I wrote about are kind of the people who didn't change their minds. A lot of people did change their minds and said, well, it turns out that sometimes there are wars that have to be fought, right? Just wars. Mm-hmm. And the people that I'm writing about still maintain that this was a mistake. They found themselves increasingly isolated and increasingly marginalized, and even possibly under criminal suspicion. Right, there were laws that were passed to that effectively criminalized a lot of anti-war speech. These were ministers who lost their pulpits, right, who were essentially fired from their jobs. And so it was a kind of crisis for them. World War I was a crisis of what they had thought, the way that kind of progress was going, and also what they thought kind of their where they fit into America, right? They said, I think these people kind of, a lot of them, the early ones, didn't intend to be radicals, you know, but they kind of found themselves in that position almost by accident. So a lot of them came together in the Fellowship of Reconciliation. The other thing that happened was some of them actually went to Europe. Some young people who were involved, especially with the YMCA, which a Christian group centered on, did a lot with colleges. I think it's a little bit like the Peace Corps today, with a combination of kind of humanitarian service and overseas adventure. But the YMCA was more explicitly Christian. So some people in my book went over to Europe, worked with prisoners of war, worked with the soldiers, worked in relief camps. And that experience for them was transformative in seeing the effects of the war. They weren't necessarily always on the front lines, but seeing the wounded and seeing the way that religion had been put into the service of war in a way that they found upsetting, that they found that they thought was wrong, that the war had essentially been Christianized, right? Mm-hmm. That there were YMCA ministers and so on who were supposed to preach to the troops, and the kind of and the line between being a Christian and being a good soldier was really became blurred, right? So mm-hmm. you have people at home who are experiencing this climate of anti-war or pro-war, kind of pro-war nationalism and kind of vilification of anti-war sentiments. And then you have people in Europe who are seeing this and experiencing this, and they all kind of came together in this group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation that was formed during the war. Actually, it was formed before the U.S. even entered at this kind of earlier and easier moment when just Europe was at war. But then it became kind of radicalized during and after the war, after the entrance of the U.S. Into the war. And that's the group that I kind of traced through the book.
I thought one of the most fascinating things about the book was precisely the way in which you portray the YMCA. We usually don't think about the YMCA as a child of the progressive era. But the way it is portrayed in your book, which was fascinating to me as somebody who grew up in a YMCA playing basketball, not ever thinking that it was Christian in any way, really, that it really was kind of a progressive era institution. And if I understood the book correctly, these people thought that many Christians had been shown to be hypocrites by World War One. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that happened, as I see it, kind of the unintended consequences of ideas, maybe, that these people in the YMCA, the YMCA had been saying to these young college people, and the YMCA was really prominent in elite colleges, you know, Princeton and so on. But the YMCA view was like, you know, you need to dedicate your life to Jesus, to follow his example. You know, and that's a total commitment. That's something that takes up should extend to every part of your life. Now, that wasn't intended to mean you should go to jail for opposing the draft. You know, that wasn't what they meant in 1910 or whatever, when, you know, someone heard that in college. But that way of looking at the world, we should follow Jesus wherever that leads, kind of led them, some of them, to think about war in this way, right? Mm-hmm. To think, well, if Jesus is the Lord of my life, then that means I can't participate in war. And a lot of the YMCA leaders actually backed off from that, and didn't, you know, they didn't themselves become pacifists. And so one of the big leaders of the YMCA, John Mott, who kind of starts the FOR, leaves a couple of years later because he was interested in kind of the ideal of peace in a general way, but he didn't mean to make this like strong political statement of pacifism. And when the lines get drawn really sharply, he backs off. But yeah, the people that I'm writing about were especially disappointed by Christians and the Christian church. Politicians, you know, you can expect this kind of thing from them, or this kind of hypocrisy. But Christians they had expected would have been more consistent, right, and been more that made a stronger case against the war. And this is, you know, part of this too is it's not just they weren't just thinking about America, right? They were thinking about Europe too, which was supposedly the home of Christianity, and that was of course connected to civilization, right? In a more, maybe in a, you know, in political sense, in a cultural sense, And so World War One destroys that idea, at least for these people, that Europe and America are kind of together leading the world in religious and political and cultural values. Mm-hmm. Right? And some of these, a lot of the people in my book have tied it to missionaries and that world of foreign missions, which is also often in the 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, before leading up to World War II, which is often motivated by this idea that we are going to take the light of Christianity and often kind of Western culture to people who need it. And so World War One seems to show for the people in my book and a lot of other people too that model of what Western civilization as being superior is bankrupt, right? Mm-hmm. That there's it's kind of indefensible now to go and enlighten the heathen in Africa or somewhere else, given what's happened in Europe during World War One. So there's a great deal about hypocrisy and about how, for my people, how one could be a consistent Christian in the face of all this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, one of the other really interesting things about this group of people is that although they never achieved their aim, that is, a world without war, they did begin many strains or movements or traditions that are with us today and are much beloved. And we're going to mention several of them. The first of them is civil liberties and conscience subjection. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the way in which they engaged and sort of started the modern movement to protect civil liberties during World War One.
Sure. And I think you're right that a lot of this book, again, is about unintended consequences, right? That they didn't succeed at ridding the world of war, obviously. But there were other kinds of things that happened. And I think it's, we're thinking about that question in history and, the history of social movements or dissenters or failed groups more generally. Like, do they have legacies that live on even if they failed at what they said they were trying to do? So civil liberties, and it's something that doesn't seem immediately connected to war, but ended up being very closely connected to war, because the people in the United States, on the home front in the United States, experienced the war really as an assault on civil liberties, as an assault on free speech, and so on. So they're arrested for making anti-war speeches. The most famous case is the socialist Eugene Debs, who's arrested. There's a great book about that came out by Ernest Freeberg called Democracy's Prisoner. But some of my people, the Christian pacifists, were arrested too, which sort of horrified them because they didn't necessarily think of themselves as radicals like Eugene Debs, or communists or something. And they were kind of shocked to find that they were put in the same category as these people simply because they opposed the war. Again, they were kind of reluctant radicals at the beginning, but they got very involved in civil liberties for those free speech, because of those free speech issues, and also because of conscientious objection. And World War One raises the question of the draft in a real way. What can the state do as far as claiming your body for war? And what the pacifist experience revealed was that nobody quite knew what to do with these people who refused to fight. There are a lot of people who refused to fight, who dodged the draft, who left the country or just kind of hid out. And then, before the age of computers and GPS and so on, it was actually kind of hard to find people, in rural Arkansas or whatever, if they wanted to hide out and if they had the support of the local community. So actually a lot of people did that. But the people in my book were actually wanted to be very clear They were not draft dodgers, and they you know, signed up as conscientious objectors and made it very clear that they were specifically protesting being drafted. They weren't trying to get out of something. They weren't scared. But they just believed that this was wrong. And so in other wars, in later wars, there was more of a system, alternative service and other things for handling these two people. But in World War One, there really wasn't. And these people were often sent to military camps, and then they had these endless debates. There was no real place for them, especially if they weren't part of an established peace church. In other words, it was one thing if you said, I'm a Mennonite or something, and my church has always believed in pacifism, right? But a lot of these people were from different traditions, and they didn't really think that you should have to belong to a church that was considered pacifist to the rights of a conscientious objector. So no one quite knew what to do with them. So they went to these military camps, and then it was a series of endless debates. Did they have to wear a military uniform? Could they be ordered to rake the leaves around the camp, or was that a form of military service? Did they have to prepare their own food? So some of them went on a hunger strike because they said, we're basically in prison, and the state should provide for us. And it wasn't clear, but nobody knew what to do. And so actually some pretty terrible things ended up happening, and they basically, some of them were basically subjected to what we today call torture, I mean, being chained to prison bars for hours or days, and in other ways badly treated. And they were eventually sentenced to long jail terms for not obeying their military superiors. So anyway, the FOR and other groups got very involved in these questions of civil liberties. And actually the ACLU, the group that becomes the ACLU that we usually think of as defending the Ku Klux Klan and defending marginal groups for their free speech rights, the ACLU is very much and its precursor are very much engaged during World War One in these questions of conscientious objection and of winning rights for conscientious objectors. So the roots of our civil liberties regime today are in mm-hmm. are partly in with these pacifists, and it becomes a question. It is a question that's related to violence, right? Because we can see that the restriction of speech is sometimes seen as a kind of violence, right? And the line is blurry, right? As we see with this debate over burning the Quran, right? Which is mm-hmm. partly implicated in questions of free speech and also raises issues of violence. So actually these things are much more, civil liberties and violence are much more closely tied than we sometimes think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if I could ask you to just jump forward a little bit, one of the things that you say in the book is that the period which is bracketed by World War One and World War Two was really not a very, how should I say it? It was not a very comfortable one for the pacifists. And one of the, for obvious reasons and for reasons that aren't obvious, and I want to talk about one of the non-obvious reasons, and that is the way in which they tried to deal with socialism in the Soviet Union, because my understanding of socialist history is that many socialists were pacifists prior to World War One. And there were still, and I know this from my own studies of Russian history and communist history, there were still large groups of pacifist groups within the communist movement. And so there seemed to be kind of a natural affinity between FOR and these various socialist and communist movements. But they also had a kind of rocky relationship with them. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that.
That's right. I mean, one of the ways to think about this book is that this is a history of the religious left, or one part of the religious left. But I always am nervous about saying that because these people had a really uncomfortable place on the left. And in some ways, they had a lot in common with communists and socialists. And some of them did consider themselves socialists and voted for the Socialist Party. But especially with the communists, there was tension. And there was tension in part because of their similarity. Both groups were interested in the working class and labor and justice for workers, right? Improving the plight of workers. And both groups were interested in racial equality, which becomes central, right? And so, weirdly, pacifists are often, the pacifists in my book are often called communists because they talk about racial equality just like the communists do back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. And the communists are involved, as you say, in various kinds of peace efforts and in various kinds of anti-fascist efforts in the 20s and 30s. But there's this distinction that is sometimes not so important, but becomes important at crucial points. That communists believe that some kinds of violence are acceptable. That class warfare is acceptable, is necessary. And the pacifists in my book disagree with that. So they have fundamentally at the bottom. There's a difference in philosophy that becomes a difference in practice. So pacifists in my book are very skeptical of the Soviet Union. They're skeptical of communist labor organizing, right, which they feel like is could lead to class warfare. And it becomes important in things like the Spanish Civil War in 35, 36, which some people see as a kind of rehearsal or precursor to the Second World War. And a lot of the American left supports the Spanish Civil War. Including a lot of communists, right? Because this is seen as a war between fascists and the left in Spain there. But the pacifists a lot of them do not want to support the Spanish Civil War. Some of them will make statements about in support of the left there. But a lot of them don't want to be part of it. And this creates a break and kind of shows the fault line between believing in pacifism, right, and believing that the real problem here is violence, so you don't support this war, even though it seems like one side is kind of espousing the goals that you want. Mm-hmm. The difference between that view that takes violence as a problem and the difference between the view of socialists and communists that took fascism or capitalism as a central problem, and sometimes you had to use violence to fight against these things. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting for me to see the way that these different groups on the left kind of espouse these different philosophies, which had certain kinds of implications later on.
Yeah, how did they deal with the question of avowed communist atheism?
Yeah, well, that was another problem, and one that the pacifists linked to the question of violence, that they thought that in some ways the atheism of communism was what allowed them to countenance violence because they had no sense of religion as a source of morality. They had no sense of of Christian religious fellowship, right? And so the people in my book are a neglected or kind of overlooked group, which is the anti-communist left. we often think of anti-communism in the United States as being Joseph McCarthy or the kind of far right conspiracy theorist, right? Even now, we have people are equating Obama with communism, right? This is a kind of conservative obsession, right? But I think there are other kinds of anti-communism which were not like that. And the people in my book actually were tried to distance themselves from McCarthy in the 50s and earlier versions of that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And they really wanted to carve out a place on the left that was distinct from communism. And that's one of the reasons, for instance, that they turned to Gandhi, because here is a guy who was an anti-imperialist, who seemed to be an anti-capitalist, who was a believer in racial equality, but definitely not a communist. And so that's one of the reasons they seized on him. So it's, I think the story of radicalism and the left in the 20th century in the world has been mostly the story of communism, which makes sense because it is the most important radical movement. But I wanted to show that there are these other kinds of positions. It's not just pacifists. I mean, there's feminists and other groups who could also be considered to be on the left, but were in a different place than communism. And the questions that people had after the fall of the Berlin Wall about what becomes of the left, can anything be salvaged or whatever, and the kind of loss of communism kind of discrediting either morally or politically, I think opens a place for us to look at these other kinds of groups again and see the kind of diversity that was there on some of these issues.
I see. So let's skip forward a little bit to another one of these strange issues that the pacifists supported and promulgated that then was in a certain sense kind of taken away from them. I guess that they probably wouldn't agree with that characterization, but developed a life of its own, and that is the cause of civil rights here in the guise of racial equality. How did they get involved in this in the 1950s?
Yeah, well, civil rights have been important to them for a long time, and one of the things that I am in dialogue with, although I have a slightly different take on it than some other scholars, but a lot of scholars have seen the civil rights movement is something that we have to extend backwards before Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 or the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 or 1956, to look back at World War II, back to the 1930s, and even further back, I can see this broader movement. And the people in my book were part of that broader movement. They were thinking about these issues in World War II. Some prominent black leaders, black civil rights leaders, joined the FOR during World War II. Bayard Rustin, who's eventually going to be an organizer of the March on Washington, James Farmer, who is going to be the head of the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, James Lawson eventually joins the FOR, who's going to lead the sit-ins and be active in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So it's a remarkable thing that starts before we think of it, starting with, on a very small scale in the 1930s and 40s, just a few people. But in the 1950s, it grows into something bigger, and that's the 50s and 60s. I think is the kind of heyday of these people when their work that had been done in a very small way earlier on gained much more power, and especially gained power in the Montgomery bus boycott, which was again a kind of collection of coincidences and unintended consequences, but also something that people had prepared for in a general way. The FOR wasn't really involved initially with the Montgomery bus boycott or with Rosa Parks. But when they found out about it, they got involved, and they sent a couple of people. Bayard Rustin was one, and later they sent a white one of their white leaders named Glenn Smiley to advise Martin Luther King and to work out how nonviolence would operate in this bus boycott. And they weren't the only people doing this, but I think that they played key roles. And if you read you know, the sources, you can see that they played key roles in doing this. They made a film about the boycott, which they showed around the South in Montgomery and elsewhere. The FOR did that. They made a comic book. If you get my book, you can see a mm-hmm. picture of the Martin Luther King comic book, not a well-known a source in popular culture, but it was a book that a comic book that told the story of Gandhi and also the story of King and the bus boycott. And this was distributed around the South, especially in to African American colleges and churches and so on. And so the FOR both worked with King on the strategy of nonviolence and what that would look like, and also on popularizing this movement and getting the word out as to what was going on, and trying to explain to people why this is a good idea. Because the thing that I think important to remember is that nonviolence wasn't obvious. And sometimes we tend to think of it as some kind of natural development, like it came out of the black church and the people in the black church were black Christians were really nice, so of course they used nonviolence. But in fact, nonviolence is very counterintuitive, right? It's not something that you would think of or that would seem to be effective. And so the FOR in the bus boycott and in the civil rights movement has to train people, right, and has to discipline people. They practice this, you know, when the buses are integrated, and everybody's going to go and sit wherever they want. There's a lot of fear that there's going to be violence, and there is a little violence, mostly on the white side. But they practice. They set up chairs in Martin Luther King's church, and people are they play white bus riders and black bus riders, and you know, somebody yells at somebody else and pushes them, and you practice like not pushing back. And so one of the things I wanted to get at was the way that nonviolence was not just a good idea or a thing that Jesus said that you should do, but it was a technique and a discipline and something that had to that people had to work on and people had to mm-hmm. had to practice, just like any other kind of political organization would need that kind of, would require that kind of discipline. So they were really important in the civil rights movement, both at the level of kind of ideas of racial equality, ideas of nonviolence, and also thinking about tactics, like how were civil rights protests going to operate, and what would be effective. And I think they're overlooked a little bit in the way we talk about the way we talk about the civil rights movement, and I think they show kind of where it came from and how it got put together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's odd. You mentioned this. You mentioned a Martin Luther King comic book. I doubt anybody knows this, but I actually wrote the script, so to say, or the text for a book for young adults, a comic book on the Little Rock Nine, and this came out a couple of years ago. And I worked with an artist doing it, and it's really quite a nice book. As I say, it's for young adults. But one of the scenes in the book portrays exactly what you're talking about, that before they go to the school, the Little Rock Nine, they rehearse trying not to react to the angry crowds and to the police and everything else. They literally go through it. And so some of the students yell at other students. This is in the living room of a kind of famous civil rights activist whose name I can't remember right now, but they literally go through it. They role play it in order to become to become habituated not to respond in the normal way, which would be to become angry and violent yourself. So it was interesting to hear that. In the 1960s and 70s, they branch out into other activities. For example, the FOR is important in the anti-Vietnam War movement, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, so something interesting happens in the 50s and 60s. You know, for most of the book, they're this very small group of people, this, you know, minority, marginal, I mean, well, in terms of numbers, even on the left, right? And then in the 50s and 60s, you know, there's the decline of communism and the repression of communism in some ways, and the, you know, the rise of the civil rights movement and this kind of religious dissent, right? So these folks then become in the 50s, 60s much more powerful than they had been, and nonviolence becomes a kind of mass movement rather than this avant-garde project of a few people. So that creates new kinds of opportunities and new kinds of difficulties. So they are leaders in the anti-Vietnam War movement. In fact, one of the guys that I talk about who's central to the book is A.J. Musty, who first gets involved in FOR during World War One. He's a minister. He loses resigns from his pulpit because he feels he can't. His congregation doesn't accept his views. He gets active in the labor movement for a while, and even becomes a kind of Marxist and basically leaves religion, comes back, decides that Christianity is really the only true form of radicalism, and comes back and becomes the leading opponent of World War II, opponent of U.S. intervention in World War II, and then in the 50s and 60s, gets involved in anti-nuclear protests and civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protests. So he's now, you know, in the 60s, he's an old man, but he's still out there doing this stuff and actually goes to Vietnam and becomes a kind of model example for a younger generation of people. So he's a really fascinating character who kind of who went through the entire century pretty much with this pacifist conviction, and one of the central characters in my book. And there are other people who are active in the anti-Vietnam war movement. And again, I think it's important to say that, like, they had been doing this for a long time. And so again, we sometimes think of like the anti-Vietnam War movement as this explosion of anti-war sentiment. But at least for the people in my book, they've been thinking about draft resistance and anti-imperialism and the Cold War and all those questions for quite a while. And so they were able to be quite influential in the movement when it got big. I mean, the other thing that happened was that Catholics came to play an increasingly important role in Catholic radicalism, and nonviolence became important in the anti-Vietnam War period. Primarily through the Catholic worker movement, which I don't talk a whole lot about, but which is important for this story too. The Catholic worker movement that starts in the 30s opposes World War II, and eventually those, because there's not too many people opposing World War II, those Catholic workers and the FOR people eventually find each other and do some early civil rights activity, and then later get involved in anti-Vietnam War action. And so it becomes, I think, in the 60s, more of a interfaith effort. And the FOR is much more interfaith, like, now than in the time I was writing about it. You know, at the time it starts, there's a lot of anti-Catholicism, right, among Protestants. And this is really kind of a Protestant group. They reach out to Jews a little bit. But in the 60s, there becomes more of a sense of religions working together against war. And I think that's one of the things that changes in the 60s. But they do have this presence throughout the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So the FRR exists today. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It exists today, and they have headquarters in Nyack, New York, so over the Tappan Zee Bridge. I visited there. They're doing the research, and they still are active in this work. They've been especially active in the Middle East and in in thinking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They are still, to me, focused on this kind of, they're still not a huge group, and they never have been, and they're really focused on these kinds of small, seemingly small scale actions and on kind of the value of those. In that sense, I think they do have something in common with the Quakers in thinking about the kind of value of the individual and kind of the individual's action. But yeah, they're still around. You can find them on the web and other places. They publish a journal called Fellowship that really, I think calls attention to some of calls attention on the bad side to some of the forms of violence that we don't often read about in the media, but also more positively calls attention to the efforts that people are making in the Middle East and elsewhere that often don't get talked about in the media. So still quite a fascinating group.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're almost out of time, but I really want to ask you a question that's it's kind of inside baseball for historians or theologians or people that think about religion. But I really have to ask you, one of the people you talk a lot about in the book is Reinhold Niebuhr. Our president is fond of quoting Reinhold Niebuhr, I think. I don't think I'm wrong in saying he does not come off well in your book. In fact, I was reading some of it to my wife last night, and he doesn't even come off as very Christian, really. What did the people in the FOR think about Niebuhr? What is your take on him?
Yeah, Reinhold Niebuhr. I'm thrilled that Obama is quoting someone from my book. It's probably the only maybe Martin Luther King as well. In some ways, I think it's good that Obama is reading Reinhold Niebuhr and thinking about some of the issues of moral action, religion, politics at that level, right? Like any kind of reflection in that way is probably good at some level, right? Niebuhr is, I actually have a lot of respect for Niebuhr, and I think his insights are really good. So Niebuhr starts out as early on he's a pacifist. He joins the FOR and is one of their leaders. And then later he breaks with them in the 1930s and says that pacifism is not viable, that there are some times when you have to fight because we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world of sin and evil, and if you want to be involved in politics, you have to sometimes make certain kinds of compromises. And then Niebuhr becomes the great Christian defender of U.S. intervention in World War II. He has an essay called "Why the Christian Church is Not Pacifist," which I assigned in my class, which talks about how one has to balance the Christian ideals of love and justice. You can't always be loving because sometimes justice involves violence. The pacifist criticism of Niebuhr was a couple things, right? They thought, but I think their sharpest criticism of him was that he, even though he had a fairly specific view of what was a just war and when one would have to use violence. And he's actually very careful to say that most wars are not justified and nonviolence is probably good for most of the time. But what the pacifist said was that Niebuhr actually, and this was in some sense true, that Niebuhr kind of got co-opted, and people used his arguments to kind of justify any U.S. military action that happened along. And that, you know, once you had compromised, once you had said, well, violence is sometimes okay, it was very easy. It was hard to know when to stop compromising, so that the difference between Reinhold Niebuhr and there's not much difference, A.J. Musty says, between Reinhold Niebuhr and John Foster Dulles, right, mm-hmm. the Cold Warrior. And so you had to keep, so Musty says you have to keep this absolutist position, which I don't necessarily agree with. I don't necessarily consider myself a pacifist. But I think that, I think the thing to notice about Reinhold Niebuhr, and I think that the thing that, Obama could probably read a little more in this, is that Niebuhr is actually really critical of most wars. He really does keep he started off as a pacifist, and he still has some of that idea of that a lot of wars are not justified. And so he actually, at the end of his life, actually comes out against the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Despite his disagreements with the pacifists, this is something they all agreed on. So even though Niebuhr is not a pacifist and says violence is sometimes acceptable, I think it's important to see that he was still often very critical of American military action.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for answering that question about Niebuhr. I just was interested to hear an expert speak about him. I haven't read him for a long time, but it certainly is. I agree with you that it's good that Obama's reading Niebuhr, I guess. Kip, it's really been great having you on the show today. We're just about out of time, but I want to take this opportunity to ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm just finishing an article which takes off on some of my interest in nonviolence and civil rights and religion, to look at protests at churches during the civil rights movement in the South. So African American students would go, or other people would go to white churches and try to sit in on Sunday morning for services. These were often called kneel-ins. And sometimes they were allowed in, but sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they were even arrested. And this showed, in some ways, that Southern white churches, even those who were evangelical and were supposed to be trying to save everybody, didn't allow African Americans into their into membership or even to attend on Sunday morning. And this is a part of segregation that I think has not been studied in this way. I mean, we think about the lunch counters and the buses and so on, but this is a site of conflict at churches. So I'm just working on that as another piece of, I guess, this broader story about nonviolence, civil rights, and race.
Well, it certainly sounds fascinating, and good luck with it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Kip, thanks very much for being on the show today. I really appreciated talking to you.
All right. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Kip Kosek about his new book, Acts of Conscience, Christian Nonviolence, and Modern American Democracy. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.